From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, all eyes were on John Roberts Jr., the U.S. appellate judge nominated to replace Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. With only 2 years' experience as a judge under his robe, Roberts has offered few public clues as to his judicial philosophy. But we can assume he met President Bush's central requirement, as stated during Campaign 2000.
I don't believe in liberal activist judges. I believe in strict constructionists, and those are the kind of judges I will appoint.
Yes, we've learned all week the nominee is a constructionist, but not an activist or an extremist or a Methodist or any number of ists. The media were awash in such terms, including traditionalist, originalist, and pragmatist. But what do they mean, and more importantly, do they tell us what we need to know? To help walk us through the list of ists, we consulted Professor Stanley Fish of the law school faculty at the Florida International University. We began by asking about the president's bid specifications for a strict constructionist.
Many people who use strict constructionism mean textualism, by which they mean sticking to the meanings that are encoded in the text and not going beyond them.
According to a piece you wrote in the New York Times, the text can never speak for itself. Tell me why.
It is always possible to ask, even of the most explicit words, what does that mean? What did you mean by that? A good example would be in many marriages, a wife will say to her husband, why don't we go to the movies tonight? What does that mean? The answer to that question depends on the history of the marriage, the kind of relationship they have, the kind of person the husband thinks the wife is. The words themselves will not produce a fixed account of their meaning.
Never mind going to the movies. Tell me what they mean when they say, does this dress make me look fat? This is actually something I need to know.
Exactly right. You know what the answer has to be. It has nothing to do with the supposed fixed meanings that words have, and everything to do with the intentions that you ascribe to people with whom you interact, especially if you've been married to them for 25 years.
Okay, now let's go out of the fanciful back into the actual Constitution and look for a moment at just the Establishment Clause. It seems to be, for example, quite explicit that the state shall establish no religion. Mm-hmm. Isn't that more or less a black and white statement?
Not at all. Because then the argument has to be, what is the meaning of establishment? Is it establishing a religion when you allow tax credits for religious institutions? Is it establishing a religion when you allow students to organize prayers at high school football games? These are all issues, as you know, that have been adjudicated in the courts. The Establishment Clause does not give you the answer to these questions. You have to say something about what the framers had in mind and then figure out what they might have said if this particular new set of facts were given to them.
You know, I'm beginning to feel like a masochist, but let me talk about another ist word, traditionalist.
I think that when most people use that term, they mean someone who is respectful of precedent. That is, who will look at what is settled law and tend to try to extend settled law rather than to overturn it.
And then we've also heard the term invoked activist.
Yes.
This has been used by the president to describe those who he believes would legislate from the bench, would usurp Congress's authority to create law from the bench. But do you believe that it's a fair descriptor?
Well, everyone calls the judge who issues an opinion he or she does not agree with a judicial activist. Everyone believes that his or her view of what the text says is plain, perspicuous, and obvious, and therefore that anyone who disagrees with it must be engaged in a willful act of activism.
So, for example, the political right could call the Earl Warren Court the pantheon of judicial activism, but those from the left could say that Justice Scalia and Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Rehnquist are activists from the right.
Absolutely. And actually, these legal categories can migrate from one side of the political aisle to the other, and often do. For example, the doctrine of settled law at one point for 50 or 55 years was used to maintain the separate but equal policy first announced in Plessy versus Ferguson, and that was then overturned by the court in 1954. But now settled law is being advocated by those who wish to retain the Roe v. Wade decision, giving women at least limited rights to abortion.
As we follow the debate and the confirmation process, is there any other terminology that we should listen for to make sure that it isn't being abused either by committee members or by the press?
Well, I don't think that any of these terms should be part of the conversation and part of the hearings. Judges should be asked to describe the way they go about assessing evidence. What kinds of principles are they going to apply? If the questioning goes in that direction, you have a feel for the way in which the nominee thinks. If you allow these categories, like strict constructionist, textualist, and judicial activist, to rule the discussion, you'll be talking not about what judges really do, but about caricatured versions of what judges really do, and that won't be a good idea.
All right. Well, Professor Fish, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Longtime scholar of literary theory, Professor Stanley Fish is now a member of the law school faculty at Florida International University in Miami.
This week, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on a proposed federal shield law that would grant journalists a special privilege to keep their sources confidential, even if called to testify. The Justice Department failed to appear, but in statements prepared ahead of time, Deputy Attorney General James Comey opposed the bill as, quote, bad public policy, primarily because it would bar the government from obtaining information about media sources even in the most urgent of circumstances. Lucy Dalglish, head of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, told the New York Times that from 1973 to 1978, there were 99 legislative attempts at a federal shield law. None passed. But that did not deter 9 lawyers and journalists from testifying for a shield. Here's one of the lawyers, Lee Levine.
In all, over the last 4 years, 3 federal courts of appeals have affirmed contempt citations issued to reporters who declined to reveal confidential sources, each court imposing prison sentences on journalists more severe than any previously known in American history.
Lee Levine represents Los Angeles Times and Associated Press reporters in the investigation into who leaked information about nuclear scientist Wenho Lee, who lost his job at Los Alamos in 1999. We haven't discussed this case for a while, so we've asked Paul McMasters, First Amendment Ombudsman for the Freedom Forum, to bring us up to speed.
The Wenho Lee case goes all the way back to the early 80s when the FBI and the Energy Department first got interested in him. And over the next 2 decades, they regarded him first as a potential spy and then as a potential source. So this went back and forth for quite some time until they wanted to nail him for stealing secrets about missiles and sharing them with China.
And so they basically tried to sweat the suspect by leaking stuff about him to the media.
That is one interpretation of it. I think part of the reason for leaking, too, was the feeling by some officials that they needed to let the public know that they were doing something. The end result was that they filed 59 charges against Mr. Lee, wound up not being able to make the case for 58 of them, and he pled guilty to one and got off on the basis of the 9 months he'd already served in isolation. Subsequent to that, Mr. Lee filed a lawsuit against the Department of Energy, the FBI, and the Department of Justice against unknown individuals who may have leaked information, and the claim was that that was in violation of the Privacy Act and that his reputation was harmed. In trying to get to the bottom of that, his attorneys deposed more than 20 people in those departments and still were not able to find out who the sources were, and so they then went after 6 reporters who had dealt with those sources one from the Associated Press, two from the New York Times, one from the Los Angeles Times, and one from CNN, who now works at ABC. Another reporter will be coming up on August the 2nd, and he's from the Washington Post, Walter Pincus.
There was an appeal late last month. The court came back and rejected the reporter's arguments and said they must testify. So what happens if they don't? Will any of these reporters be following Judith Miller to jail?
I think that's an awfully good possibility, because for the same reasons that Judy Miller went to jail, these reporters feel duty-bound to protect their sources.
Now, when New York Times reporter Judith Miller refused to reveal who leaked to her the name of CIA operative Valerie Plame, even some journalists thought that she should have, that in fact, hers was a poor case on which to hang arguments for a reporter's right to protect sources. Is the Wen-Ho Lee case a better sell for a journalist shield law?
The Wen-Ho Lee case is a much better sell on its facts. We're talking here about not a crime per se. We're talking about an attempt to get civil damages for an alleged harm to the reputation. And the attorneys representing those reporters don't believe that Mr. Lee and his attorneys have gone far enough in trying to determine those sources on their own.
They did depose 20 people.
20 people, and the attorneys for the reporters point out a long list of other people who probably could be deposed in all three of those departments that are named in the suit. Additionally, they say that the Privacy Act, which Wen-Ho Lee says was violated, doesn't really cover some of the circumstances under which the reporters were writing their articles. And it's important to note here that while Mr. Lee's suit focuses on the damage done to his reputation by the early reporting, the fact of the matter is that the media was very helpful in making his case for him later on in its reporting.
But on the bright side, wouldn't a decision against the reporters in this case also discourage malicious leakers from trying to do their dirty work through reporters or behind the shield of reporter confidentiality?
I suppose you might read it that way. What I would think is it would discourage malicious leakers and all other leakers. The fact of the matter is, even a malicious leak can be put to good purpose.
All right. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Paul McMasters is the First Amendment Ombudsman for the Freedom Forum.
Coming up, soldiers who fight to preserve history on the battlefield.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The complete history of any military engagement, from Gettysburg to Guadalcanal, Tonkin to Tikrit, is left behind on the field of war. What remains is the stuff of textbooks, the documents and memories of living participants. And it is this material that the members of the 45th Military History Detachment are racing to preserve. Seven Army historians are now traveling throughout Iraq, risking their own lives to interview soldiers and gather documents for posterity. Whether the effort was worth the risk will be determined years from now when that material is declassified. Meanwhile, we can ask the command historian, Lieutenant Colonel John Boyd, about the work in progress. He's on the phone from Baghdad. Colonel Boyd, welcome to OTM.
Well, thank you very much.
I would guess that for us civilians, the classic image of the Army historian would be some dusty old academic studying ancient battles from the safety of his office. But this is very clearly different from the work you do in Iraq.
Absolutely. And of the historians that we have in theater right now, I'm probably the only one that qualifies as being kind of old and crusty. I'm actually a PhD at a university in Kentucky. But all soldiers, be they historians here or anybody else, are required to be fit to potentially engage in a conflict. So we consider ourselves soldiers first and historians second.
Does the tradition of this kind of officially sanctioned on-the-ground compiling of history go back as far as World War II or even further than that?
At least over 100 historians were actually deployed to different theaters in World War II. By the Vietnam era, we had the creation of what we call the Military History Detachment, and the Army loves acronyms. In this case, a Military History Detachment looks at what we call We Paid, and that basically means that we go after today web pages, electronic media, photos, artifacts, interviews, and documents. And the thing that we have discovered in Iraq is the Army has become paperless. I came over here expecting to find documents, and what I found was that everything is emails and computer-generated documents, and so we find ourselves in a new modern crisis for history collectors, and that is we don't have enough hard drive to actually get all the material right now, and that's what we discovered.
So that puts an even greater emphasis on the interviews that you gather. But I'm wondering, as you interview individual soldiers about the work they're doing, how do you get them first to even trust you or to open up?
Unlike a reporter, I think we have some things going for us. One, they're approached by a fellow soldier, some of which have already engaged in combat. We have one military history detachment commander who actually earned a combat infantry badge at Fallujah while he was doing his job. There's two ways you can look at military history, and this is the PhD in me that just has to come out right now, and that's history from the top down or history from the bottom up. Military historians, of course, are all fascinated with plans and actions in the synchronized modern battlefield, and so we get that stuff. We get where the little arrows go and what little task force did this or that. But the other thing is ultimately, there are people out there that are fascinated with what is battle really like. And so many times my sergeants or I encounter someone that will, with enough coaxing at times, open up and, you know, what is it like to be shot at? What is it like to shoot somebody?
Do you find some soldiers reluctant to talk to you because they lump you in with other journalists with the bias against the larger media?
It's interesting that you say that, because usually when I conduct an interview, the first words out of my mouth are, I am not the press, and I am not a reporter. I am here to tell your story, and I'm here to get it right.
But ultimately, your mission isn't fundamentally different from the mission of journalism. Do you worry that your work will be seen not as history, but as a government-sponsored version of history?
We don't tell the soldier what to say. Indeed, a lot of cases I'm looking for the same thing a reporter's looking for. I'm looking for things that might actually be lessons learned for the Army. I do want to know the good, the bad, and the ugly, as I sometimes put it. So I've gotten some information which is not necessarily always very pretty. I think the record should speak for itself. Any researcher ultimately will have access to the information that we preserve, and they can interpret it the way they want to.
You've said that World War I was a particularly literary war. What do you mean by that?
I appreciate the question because I've pondered it ever since I read a wonderful book by a gentleman named Paul Fussell. And in one of his books, he has a chapter about World War I called Oh, What a Literary War. And he talks about the amount of mail and ability of soldiers sitting around between moments of terror to write. The interesting comparison that I make is perhaps even daily entries done by soldiers in Iraq on blog sites, some of which are officially sanctioned by the United States Army at this point, since they've kind of broken out like a rash all over anyway. Now, I'm not going to say that perhaps today's soldier is as literate as, a World War I poet like A.E. Housman, but having said that, I think each generation has found a way to express itself.
Do the soldier blogs find their way into your historical documents?
Sergeant First Class Fisk, who works with me, who is I consider my computer guru, has attempted to download many of these sites because, like much information here, we consider it to be perishable. Yes, ma'am.
The thing is, as you said, some of them are sanctioned, some of them are not. Do you also download the unsanctioned ones because of their unvarnished, if unsanctioned, view of the war?
Absolutely. I am not here to judge information. I'm not here to filter information. My mission is to try to get that information so that future generations of historians or even ones in the present can actually write a publishable book.
But you're waiting for historians to write those books so that the rest of us can have access to it. There's really no other way except the individual discretion of some military historian in the future.
Absolutely, but ultimately, under the Freedom of Information Act, once some things are declassified, and other things, by the way, are never classified, any historian or author or writer should ultimately have access. But some of this stuff may never be used. I think that primary material can be the equivalent of one man's trash is another man's treasure.
Lieutenant Colonel Boyd, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Lieutenant Colonel John Boyd is the command historian for the U.S. Army in Iraq.
History is shaped not just by historians or journalists. Especially when it comes to war, our perceptions often hinge on how conflicts are portrayed as screen entertainment. TV shows like Combat and Rat Patrol reduced World War II to episodic heroic adventures. Then there was MASH, which portrayed comic absurdities in a Korean War field hospital to implicitly criticize America's involvement in Vietnam. But no TV series has explicitly portrayed an ongoing U.S. military conflict, until now. Next week, the FX network will premiere Over There, a new series produced by Stephen Bochco of NYPD Blue fame, set on the front lines and the home front in the Iraq War. James Poniewozik is a columnist and critic for Time magazine. He joins me now. Jim, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
You've seen the first few episodes of Over There. What do you think?
It's very graphic. The violence is that sort of stylized, chaotic, Saving Private Ryan-influenced violence. But really, the power of the show doesn't come so much from any sort of inherent artistic goodness as a TV show. In many ways, the script and some of the characters are kind of lacking, as it does from this external knowledge that we bring to it, that even as you, Mr. and Mrs. America, are sitting on your couches watching, all this ugly stuff could be happening to your neighbor's kid or your kid right now.
The risk of doing that, of course, is to trivialize the horrors and the complexities of war. Based on the first three episodes, do you think Bochco's done a pretty good job of avoiding those traps?
I don't think he's trivialized the war at all. I mean, it's a very serious show. Its message, insofar as it has one, is really just that war is hell. It does a very good job, just sort of technically on the battlefield, of just showing the confusion. I hate to fall into this trap, by the way, that critics often do of talking about whether a war movie or a TV show is realistic or not, since, you know, I have not myself fought in Iraq. But having said that, it definitely portrays war as a really morally gray and ambiguous thing.
I was going home after a year of this shithole. And yesterday they tell me I'm staying 90 more days and taking on a squad of virgins. Because what? The sergeant you trained with had to have his tonsils out.
His opinion.
Shut up, Private.
Now, Bochco has made a point of saying that this show will be apolitical. But isn't there something in this very portrayal of a commander on the verge of losing it that is commentary about this particular war?
While the show seems to really take pains not to argue for one political side or another, that doesn't automatically mean that you can just write political issues out of it. The whole question of soldiers having their deployments extended, that is something that came up in the presidential campaign last year, and that is a definite political wedge issue. And so I think that the show really tries not to, say in the manner of MASH, put political speeches in the mouths of its characters. But it can't entirely bleed things political out of the show, and if it did, it would seem really bogus.
Okay, now I swear to you, this is a question. I actually have no opinion on this subject, but I am wondering, do you think viewers will get some sort of bad taste in their mouth to see the fictionalization of a war that is taking many, many lives in real time?
I think that there are some viewers that will be offended by this, but I really think that we as a society have moved toward more of an acceptance of seeing extreme events dealt with quickly and dramatized quickly. There's almost this fetishization in our culture now of the authentic. The people who want to watch it will be drawn by those very things that offend other people, which is their sense, at least, that they're seeing what's going on right now.
Do you think it's possible that this show, fictional and apolitical as it is, could actually raise political consciousness and the hackles of a viewing audience about a war that hitherto they learned about only from actual news?
It certainly is probably going to be more raw, more visceral than what people are seeing on, you know, on, say, the evening news. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know that I'm wise enough to say, but I would say if you have a show that's really involving people in a war that's going on, it's probably, whichever way they end up breaking, less likely that they'll stop caring about it so much.
All right. Well, Jim, as always, thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you, Bob.
James Poniewozik is a columnist and critic for Time magazine.
Crafting images for wartime viewers isn't new. During World War II, American audiences poured into movie theaters week after week to be consoled. Film critic Richard Schickel was among them, and he revisited the reels that shaped his boyhood for a memoir called Good Morning, Mr. Zip Zip Zip. But now, his mature and critical eye sometimes finds those old films contrived and misleading.
Almost every Hollywood movie, to this very day, buttresses the basic values of the country. I mean, the whole idea of certainly movies of the 40s and even of the 30s were always bringing everybody into camp and then out of camp into a heroic endeavor. Most movies were supposed to, in some way or other, either directly or metaphorically, support the war effort.
Let's talk about some of the movies that came out during the war, but that were set on the home front.
The main thing about home front movies, and they were often not necessarily even set contemporaneously. You know, a movie like Meet Me in St. Louis is set at the turn of the century. But what they emphasized was that duty might call, in that case, the father, to go elsewhere, take a job in New York in this particular case. And the family hated that idea. They hated the notion that they would have to uproot themselves, as so many Americans had to do during the war.
No, you can't. You can't do anything like you do in St. Louis.
Oh, no, darling, you're wrong.
No, no, New York is a wonderful town.
And eventually they don't have to in this movie. But before it happens, there's that song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which is about somebody having or trying to have a merry little Christmas far, far, far from home, far, far from the people and the places that they love and which shape them. And that's a big theme in domestic American movies.
What themes did Hollywood avoid during the war years, for the most part?
I mean, the Holocaust was never once mentioned in the movies. The government had surveys which indicated that America was endemically anti-Semitic. So as a war aim, the notion of rescuing Jews in Europe was thought to be, by the American government, not a good idea to put before the American people. And so we fought the war in Europe on the screen as a war of downtrodden idealists doing their best to oppose the Nazi juggernaut.
You note in your book that Hollywood seemed to be a lot tougher on the Japanese than they were on the Germans.
The Japanese were, in wartime movies, the great other. They took the place of, let's say, the American Indian. They were people who were shown to be animalistic, to be beyond the purview of civilized conduct. The Germans, according to the American government, were always to be shown to have some measure of redemptive possibility. They were shown to be people who had been misled. It was shown to be a sort of a temporary aberration on the part of the Germans.
One of the prevailing themes you note in your book is that the movies always stress the value of every individual. There's no sense of cannon fodder in the wartime movies that you saw.
The cannon fodder was always in the back of the frame. But, you know, those people who were in the starring roles, if they were forced to confront death, always did so heroically. I mean, yes, they're going to become physically dead, but that death will be redeemed. He will be remembered. They made a movie of Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls with Ingrid Bergman and Gary Cooper. And he has broken his leg and he has blown the bridge. But even so, on come the Phalangists and this little guerrilla band that he's hooked up with, which includes his lover, has to retreat. But his leg is busted, so he can't retreat. Although it seems to me he might have given it a try. I mean, you
know. No, no, stay with you.
No, each of us must do this thing alone. Do it for each other. But if you go, then I go with you. That way I go too.
There was this notion that if you were heroic and if you were American and if you were fighting for the right cause, that you would not die fully. I mean, there were a lot of, incidentally, wartime movies in which people like Spencer Tracy would die, but they would go on. You know, they would be ghosts. They would be whispering advice to Van Johnson in the next reel. Remember Tender Comrade, you know, Robert Ryan dies far away and Ginger Rogers picks up a picture of him and she has this little baby in his arms. She says, you know, I'm going to introduce you to your father. And he died for the best world you can imagine. You know, it's a world not with hate in it. And we're all going forward into prosperity and pacification and all of that. I mean, all of these tropes are just preposterous. You know, I mean, I don't say that it wasn't a good war or a war we shouldn't have fought. But, you know, the fact of the matter is we were consistently lied to. And I suppose if there's a theme to Good Morning, Mr. Zip, 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 it's that. That this is a cinema that essentially, and with malice aforethought, lied to us. And lied to us about important matters, not least of which is the Holocaust.
Well, Richard Schickel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Schickel's book is called Good Morning, Mr. Zip, 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 Movies, Memory, and World War II. We spoke to him in April of 2003.
Coming up, tangled webs in the White House briefing room and the media's top oracle, the man with the plan, Alan Greenspan.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Between the naming of a Supreme Court nominee and more bombings in London, reporters still found time to hector White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. On Thursday, The Washington Post reported that it had obtained a classified State Department memo. One paragraph, marked S for secret, identified CIA official Valerie Plame, called Valerie Wilson in the memo, as the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. The CIA classifies as secret the names of officers whose identities are covert. Therefore, say unnamed officials quoted in the Post, anyone who read the memo should have been aware that the information was classified. So then, did White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove know what he was doing when he outed Plame to reporters? Inquiring minds in the briefing room wanted to know.
So did the White House, in fact, know about her through this memo or not?
All right, thank you for wanting to proceed ahead with the investigation from this room, but I think that the appropriate place for that to happen is through those who are overseeing the investigation. The president directed us to cooperate fully, and that's exactly what we have been doing and continue to do.
But you don't deny that attorneys for Rove and others in the White House are speaking about these matters, creating a lot of these questions. Right?
As I said, we're not getting into talking about an ongoing investigation. That's what the president indicated as well.
Some White House press secretaries, like the Clinton administration's Mike McCurry, managed to stay on the media's good side by trying for candor and even showing a little remorse when he learned that he'd unwittingly lied about the president's relationship with Monica Lewinsky. But mostly, a spokesman's lot is not a happy one. Senate historian Donald Ritchie is here to tell us how unhappy. Donald, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
So the press secretary holds a senior White House position, just below the level of cabinet members, and the press secretary serves at the pleasure of the president. But who is the press secretary really supposed to work for? The president or the press or the people of the United States?
Everybody in the White House works for the president, and the press secretary works for the president. There was once a president back in the 19th century who was asked if he wouldn't appoint a press secretary, well, the equivalent, who would be good to the reporters. And he said, I have a feeling that I'd like to have somebody be good to me. And I think every president has felt that way. Press secretaries, of course, want to get the word out, but no question about it, the press secretary serves the president.
And so does that mean a press secretary ought to be expected to lie if it's necessary to defend their president? Do they?
Well, there have been situations in which press secretaries have had to lie for purposes of national security, for instance. So when President Kennedy had to get back to Washington during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he suddenly became ill and got a cold, and so they used that as a cover story. But press secretaries, for the most part, don't like to say something that's not true because they can, of course, get caught up on that issue, and their words can be thrown back at them.
It isn't only national security that may impel a press secretary to lie. Isn't that true?
There are a lot of reasons why you can't tell the story in a straight manner. But actually, in many cases, the press secretary doesn't know exactly what's going on. And the story that they get is the story they present to the public. Gerald Ford, for instance, in his first month in office, had a former newspaper reporter who was his press secretary, didn't tell him at all about what he was going to do about Richard Nixon's pardon. The press secretary had been saying he wasn't going to pardon Nixon. When he did pardon Nixon, the press secretary resigned because he'd been in a position of telling the press, his colleagues, something that was untrue.
Steve Early is considered to be the first press secretary. He served under FDR. But Roosevelt gave almost two press conferences a week. He spoke for himself for the most part.
Yes. Oh, Roosevelt was a master of the press conference. And presidents before Roosevelt had not allowed themselves to be quoted. Roosevelt pulled all these reporters. Over 100 reporters would come trooping into the Oval Office, and they could ask him questions about anything. He might not answer. You know, he really just manipulated them in a marvelous way. And so he was his own press secretary in that respect. But Steve Early, who was a former reporter, really helped to orchestrate all of this. There's 1,000 things other than just running a press conference that a press secretary does. Steve Early is listed as one of the best in the business.
Is it fair to invoke the old cliche, TV changed everything? Because James Hagerty was the first press secretary to handle a television president, and that was Eisenhower, but TV then wasn't live.
That's right, and it was because of Hagerty. Hagerty wanted television in there. He thought that the president should be able to speak directly to the public. The trouble was that Eisenhower wasn't a particularly articulate president.
There was a famous flap over the downing of the U-2 plane.
Yes, it's one of the instances in which a press secretary was caught in a lie, and it was a lie for national security purposes. They had agreed in advance that if a U-2 plane went down, they would say that it was a weather plane. And they assumed that the plane would have crashed and that the pilot would have been killed and that they could use that as a cover story. And Hagerty was aware of that. A lot of people in the administration were aware of that. When the U-2 plane crashed, it was just before the president was going to go to a summit with the Soviet leader. It was a very sensitive period, and so they brought out this weather plane, NASA weather plane story. Unfortunately for them, the pilot had survived the crash, Francis Gary Powers, and the Soviets brought him out and, in fact, were able to prove that he was working for the CIA. And a lot of reporters in Washington were absolutely astonished that the president and his press secretary, who they had trusted, would have lied flatly to them about this. It was one of the beginnings of a great deal of skepticism in the press corps about what presidents were telling them.
Now, Kennedy's press secretary during the first period of live TV was Pierre Salinger. Obviously, Kennedy himself was enormously telegenic.
Yeah, so Salinger was the sort of short, dumpy man who had a real problem with an administration that was very athletic. At one point, they sent him out on a 50-mile hike, which Kennedy was promoting. He didn't quite make the 50 miles in the process. But Kennedy, as you say, was a master of the press. He had been a reporter himself in the 1940s. He liked reporters. He gossiped with them all the time. He leaked to them all the time. And so, you know, press secretary for John Kennedy really was a second wheel to some degree.
And then you enter the Johnson administration. You have Bill Moyers, who remained a TV presence for a very long time. But before that, you had a guy named George Reedy.
That's right. Poor press secretaries under Lyndon Johnson. They suffered. There were many of them. Johnson thought that he was a master of the press. He overwhelmed the press. He sort of smothered them. He compromised them, and he made them step back instead of embracing him in the long run. He never was happy with any of his press secretaries. And he ran through them. George Reedy was a great loyalist, but was too nice to the press as far as Johnson was concerned. Bill Moyers came in, was also a very good press secretary, but not good enough for Johnson. Then George Christensen came in. So Johnson wanted people to love him, and that was the problem. He just didn't want them to question anything he was doing.
So if the press secretary is the most public face of the administration, other than the president, is that why Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, seemed to grow horns and a tail after a while?
Yes, that was an unfortunate job to have, to be Richard Nixon's press secretary, because Richard Nixon really hated the press. He was very removed from things with his press secretary, and Ziegler was also out of the loop on a lot of issues. To his advantage, he's one of the top people in the administration who didn't go to jail eventually. There's a famous instance where Ziegler was standing talking to Nixon, and Nixon told him to go out and tell the press something and then turned around and shoved him. And actually, the shove was caught on camera. And so you get this sense of Ziegler as sort of being the tool of his president rather than a sort of an equal in any way.
And yet Ziegler enters history just as Nixon did, with a quote of his own. I mean, how many press secretaries actually have a quote that lives through the decades?
This is the operative statement. The way to assess the previous comments is to assess it on the basis that they were made on the information available at that time. The president refers to the fact that there is new material. Therefore, this is the operative statement. The others are inoperative.
Yeah, that was dealing with the Watergate scandal, and he was referring to the Washington Post and to Woodward and Bernstein and their reporting, which he had dismissed steadily as fiction and fantasy. And in fact, when the tapes were revealed, it turned out that the Washington Post was right on target in their investigations. And he said, therefore, that his previous statements were inoperative. And that's an interesting word as well. I mean, that press secretaries, one of their ways of doing this is to come up with a word or a phrase or something like that that says something in a negative way that in a positive sound. And and it was quite an interesting word to say that everything I'd said before this was untrue.
So let's talk about the man of the hour now, Scott McClellan.
Well, there is an investigation that continues, and I think the president has made it clear that we're not going to prejudge the outcome of that investigation.
We already have the troops.
We're not going to prejudge the outcome of that investigation.
Do you think he's serving the president well?
I think he's presenting the information that the administration wants to come out. In that sense, he's a good reflection of his administration.
All right. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Donald Ritchie is the author of several books, including Reporting from Washington, The History of the Washington Press Corps. He's been an associate historian of the U.S. Senate since the Ford administration. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan made his semi-annual pilgrimage to Capitol Hill this week, and it may have been his last. The 79-year-old Mandarin of Monetary Policy is scheduled to retire in January. True to form, the media used the occasion to impute to Greenspan's remarks a barrage of thunderous reverberations. Stocks and bonds up, dollars down after Greenspan, for instance, was the Reuters headline. This raises the question of where the media will turn for omniscience once the Fed chairman leaves the scene. Because, as Bob observed way back in January of 2001, there's hardly a question about the economy for which, in the media at least, Alan Greenspan isn't the answer.
The lengths people go to divine the intentions of Alan Greenspan.
Let's check the briefcase indicator.
No matter how impossible that mission, the financial markets and the media that cover them keep on trying. The daily CNBC program Squawk Box actually examines the thickness of Greenspan's satchel to conclude whether an interest rate change is in the offing.
It does look kind of chubby.
I don't think
so. Come on, let's take another shot of it. We need to see from this side.
That looks pretty excited. Look at the way the line of the leather breaks.
Squawk Box is by no means alone in the effort to interpret every move, every utterance, every non-utterance of the inscrutable Fed chairman for signs of his intentions. Greenspan, he of the owlish expression and opaque public persona, is stalked by the press as if he were the Princess Diana, the JFK Jr., the Marilyn Monroe of monetary policy. Except he isn't dead, no matter what you may have concluded by listening to his congressional testimony.
When confronted with a period of structural change, our policy actions must be based in large part on identifying emerging trends from surprises and anomalies
When he sits down to discuss monetary policy or the course of interest rates, when he's sitting down in Congress there, nobody knows what he's talking about, and that's on purpose.
Bill Griffiths is host of CNBC's Midday Power Lunch program.
He doesn't say left or right, up or down, north or south. When all is said and done, you still don't know how hot it's going to be tomorrow.
Doesn't matter, though. The great man has spoken. Consider Lisa Singhania. She's an Associated Press reporter in New York who has the unenviable duty in each day's market wrap-up story to synthesize from the billion or 2 billion shares traded what particular news or economic forces moved the market. This exercise is approximately like finding a key phrase to describe the collected works of Aristotle.
It's a lot of educated guesswork, and one of the things you realize very quickly is that nobody knows quite what's going on in the market. But on a day where Alan Greenspan is going to do something, when the Federal Reserve is going to meet, I think it's safe to say that you won't have to worry about your lead for the day.
It's strange to recall that this man was on Gerald Ford's Council of Economic Advisors during the days of 20% inflation and was viewed skeptically by Wall Street 13 and a half years ago as a supposed political animal subject to presidential manipulation. Now he is virtually synonymous with independence, perspicacity, and something approaching papal infallibility. In a story about OPEC oil ministers, the New York Times used the phrase, without feeling any need for further explanation, Greenspan-like precision. Furthermore, he's a bona fide celebrity. What do you think of Alan Greenspan?
I heard that if whatever he says, the market follows.
What do you think of Dennis Hastert?
I don't know who that is.
What do you think of Alan Greenspan?
I think he's doing a good job.
How about Vladimir Putin? Any thoughts?
Don't know.
What do you think of Alan Greenspan?
I think he's doing a good job.
With the
market and the situation, yeah.
And what about Justin Timberlake? How do you feel about him?
Who is this?
Lead singer for NSYNC.
Don't know him.
It's hard to believe that any Federal Reserve Board member could be a household name, but thanks in no small part to the media's obsession with him, Greenspan has transcended his carefully cultivated dullness to become a somewhat aged, balding matinee idol.
He's at the top of the ziggurat.
Lloyd Grove writes the Reliable Source gossip column for the Washington Post and is himself poised, ever vigilant, on the Greenspan watch. Because, well, duh.
He's the most powerful man in the world. At least that's what I'm saying.
And that means tracking his every after 5 p.m. move. Not that Greenspan swoops through Washington with Henry Kissinger-like flamboyance. He swoops through Washington on the arm of his wife, NBC's Andrea Mitchell, with studied diffidence. He put the reserve in Federal Reserve. He is the center of a worldwide cult of non-personality.
He's not really an ebullient sort of guy. The most fascinating thing I ever heard about him is that when he takes a bath at 5:30 in the morning and thinks the great thoughts about the economy, he adjusts the water temperature by manipulating the taps with his toes.
Yeah. Finding just the right balance, neither too cool nor overheated. The point is, the man is of such mythic stature that the Washington Post is trading in his metatarsal bathwater adjustment behaviors. How weird is that? Well, actually, upon further reflection, it's not weird at all, because Greenspan is no longer merely the steward of economic expansion, nor even the master of economic expansion. Under the ever more bearish circumstances, wherein all hope is invested in one historic figure, he has become the messiah of economic expansion for the investment community and especially for those who cover it. CNBC's Bill Griffiths.
Now he's God. The media need a symbol. We need a catchphrase. We need, you know, something that will personalize a story that we, when all is said and done, don't fully understand. I mean, who understands economics? If you can give it a face, if you give it a personality, you can better explain what this is all about.
So, load up on Greenspan futures. No matter how bad the corporate news, no matter how rapidly we veer toward recession, no matter how thin the man's briefcase is, you don't have to worry about a bear market for Alan Greenspan. Because the media's obsessive fixation on the chairman of the Federal Reserve is not based on what he actually does, nor even on irrational exuberance. It is based at least as much on naked self-interest. And media self-interest, unlike economic expansion, is immutable and forever. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer and Josh Nathan Kazis. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival opening night. Airing on Live from the Lincoln Center this Thursday, July 28th on PBS, featuring pianist Stephen Huff, soprano Renee Fleming, and the Mostly Mozart Orchestra under Louis Langres, sponsored by MetLife. And the Beidel Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org, and thanks.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.